Good afternoon, everyone. We made it. We're at the last end of the last discussion of the day. So first of all, let's give a round of applause to the NMQF staff and the amazing team behind putting all this together. So my name is Dr. Donnie John. I'm the executive director of NovaScript Central, and I'm also the chairperson of the NMQF Advisory Board. I have the distinct pleasure of moderating the panel on talking about the industry's role in assisting vulnerable communities. I have some distinguished panelists with me today and joining us via Zoom that are going to provide some brilliant insight for how we can talk about collaboration. So first, let me introduce our panelists. We have Ms. Deanne Milson, the Deputy Director of Policy at the White House, Ms. Catherine Jackson, the Senior Director of Patient Engagement and Advocacy, Government Affairs, Policy and Advocacy at Mallinckrodt, Ms. Martha Orzechowski, the Head of Advocacy and Alliance at AstraZeneca and also the Executive Director of the AstraZeneca U.S. Healthcare Foundation. And online, we have Mr. Charles Redding, the CEO and President of MedShare. So let's give them a round of applause. So we've heard throughout the conversation for the past few days of how vulnerable communities are facing many challenges as it relates to social determinants of health and other healthcare needs. But we need to figure out how can we come up with solutions. We do a lot of talking, but now we need to be about action. So today's discussion is how are we going to provide and promote fostering collaboration between different stakeholders, between pharmaceutical companies and other healthcare entities here within the US. So the first question I have, and I'm going to ask Deanne, is could you provide some current insights to initiatives that the White House has actually implemented to help address the needs of vulnerable communities?
Yes. First, can everyone hear me? It seems like it. Okay. Again, my name is Deanne Millison. I'm with the White House, but specifically in the Office of the Vice President. Thank you for having me. I will say, to answer that question, it kind of starts with what is at the center of this administration, which is equity. There has been a particular focus on vulnerable communities in the Biden-Harris administration from making sure they have a voice and a seat at the table, but also making sure that the policies and the resources that we're distributing are getting to them, meeting them where they are, and are easily accessible. So because it is something that is at the center of the administration, it extends in all departments, all agencies. But I will say a couple of things as it relates to health. There's probably three things I want to highlight. One, I'm sure as most people are familiar here, I would be remiss if I didn't start with our COVID outreach. When we first arrived at the administration, the vaccination rates were just totally inequitable, totally uneven. And now we're seeing equity in the vaccination rate, meaning black families, white families, Latino families, Asian families all, you know, have equitable vaccination rates. And that was due to working directly with industry on vaccinations, treatments, and just making sure the resources get to people where they are. So from opening vaccination sites at like stadiums and things like that, from having pharmacies run 24 hours so people with all different types of work schedules can get vaccinated. And I will say it was more than just working with the pharmaceutical industry or the health industry. We worked with Uber and Lyft to provide rides to get vaccinations. We worked with YMCA and Bright Horizon for people to have childcare. So I think that is the best example of the like all hands on deck, figuring out what are the needs of vulnerable communities, what are the needs of overlooked communities, and how many partners can we work with within the health industry and beyond to meet those needs. I think we all learn from that. And the second initiative I would mention is the Vice President's work on maternal health. In December, we had a call to action to address the maternal health crisis. I'm sure you know everyone in here knows that the U.S. has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in developing nations, and there's a particular disproportionate impact on black women, on native women, and on rural women. And it's something that the vice president has been passionate about throughout her career. And so in December this past year, we had a call to action where we brought together not only the departments and agencies in the government, but also the private sector to figure out what we can do to improve maternal health outcomes. And various companies in the health industry and otherwise contributed to figure across the spectrum ways to address this crisis. And it was so unique because there was definitely, and there's probably people in this room who were a part of generating a contribution to that effort. And we saw traditional contributions, like monetary contributions, but it was wide ranging. We had the New York Fed commit to doing a report because we still need more data and we still need to learn more about this crisis. And I believe we had CVS working directly with nonprofits, Every Mother Counts, and things like that to donate money, to do implicit bias training, to Uber and Lyft, I believe, and DoorDash was giving care packets to homeless pregnant women. So there was just, that call to action just demonstrated there's so much opportunity for the private sector to really engage in these health spaces, even if it's not traditionally the work that they do, because the issues are so large. Mm-hmm. The last thing I will mention is there's a new, is recently announced a climate initiative where the administration is calling on those in the health industry to reduce their climate emissions. And it's just another way to say, obviously, the climate crisis has health implications, but it's not always something that you see companies, it's not where they initially engage, but there's just so much opportunity in the health industry to engage, to improve people's health in different ways, and the administration is really tapping into that across the board.
Perfect. Thank you for giving some specific examples of actual programs and services that are actually working right now. We've talked a lot in the previous panel learning about bills that are being proposed to promote, you know, future ideas, but it's important to be aware of the current ideas in place that are actually successful. So I'm going to ask each of the other panelists the same question. And the question is, could you each take a few minutes to explain the top one or two key areas that your company is focusing on in order to address the needs of vulnerable communities? So Catherine, can you start?
Sure. Hi. Catherine Jackson, a Senior Director of Advocacy at Mallinckrodt. And I thank you so much for having me on this panel. So as part of the industry, you know, there's a lot of things that when these kinds of needs come up and when the social issues come up, a lot of companies want to make sure they're doing the right thing and they want to get in there and do their own programs. But, you know, we really believe that the best kind of care that we can, the best support we can do is local and support the organizations that know the patients best and that are working with the caregivers and the patient community and the clinical community. So we have increased our support for initiatives that help with diversity and trials. We work in a variety of areas. We work in immunology, arthritis, in pulmonary and in MS, many different areas. And so there's different needs in every community, and there's different needs in certain areas in the community. So we don't know that. You know, we really rely on our advocacy groups, and we are very lucky that we have a very close relationship with them. So we have funded all sorts of initiatives to help on the local level, because I really believe at the end of the day, healthcare is all local. We also have a corporate social responsibility section in our company, and that is really geared towards taking care of the communities in which we work. And so where our offices are, where our plants are, where our manufacturing facilities are, we also support STEM research to help with getting that workforce involved, bringing people into the company, mentoring, things like that to just help with that issue. And then we also support in our R&D. So, you know, it's bringing in that advocacy voice, that patient and caregiver voice earlier into the R&D is very important to a company. And we're trying to work with our advocacy groups to make sure that the patients that are entering our studies are looking like the communities in which we are serving and which our medications are in, are out there and available for those communities. So you want to make sure, you know, there's just so many aspects you can do it, but I really think that the biggest thing that we do and the thing that we try to do really well is find those organizations and programs that are making a difference on that local level.
Thank you. Martha, can you?
Sure. Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, Deanna. Very, very helpful. So AstraZeneca, much like our peer companies and other organizations across the country, I think found ourselves 2 years ago in a situation really asking, what can we do and how can we do it differently? Knowing that equity has been a common theme for as long as all of us have been probably collectively working on healthcare issues, the question we really asked ourselves was, what can we do and how can we make sure that this is not an example of a performative or tactical response to the issues that were brought to light by COVID and then the subsequent murder of George Floyd? And so the first step we took was, I think, one of acknowledging that we as a company do not have expertise in health equity. And so we took a deliberate pause and brought together 13 health equity experts from across the country to launch an official health equity advisory council for AstraZeneca. I'm very excited and proud to say two of our members actually are here at the conference. Dr. Stephen Thomas and Dr. William McDade are both members of the council. And we have spent the last 18 months talking to these individuals, sharing with them information about our business model, how we work, what types of medicines we're looking to deliver to patients, and to get their insight on where are the places that we can make the biggest impact on advancing health equity in the United States. And so over the last 18 months, they've provided us counsel on the development of a 5-year roadmap for health equity that AstraZeneca will launch in the coming weeks. I think one of the most important elements of that 5-year roadmap is that it touches every single part of our business. We cannot declare victory on health equity simply by solving for clinical trial diversity or simply by solving for supporting local organizations. We really need to make sure that every single part of our business has a health equity lens front and center on the decisions we make and the collaborations that we embark on. That means everything from site selection, clinical trial protocol design, to supporting organizations who are looking to build a diverse STEM pipeline, to addressing HCP bias in the healthcare system, all the way through to some of the examples you've heard today, which are how are we partnering? Historically, we've been very good, I think, as a pharma industry at partnering at national level with big national organizations like NMQF and others. But you've heard the stories today and again over the last 25 years about the work that organizations like Sankofa and others are doing at local level. So we've also tasked ourselves with saying there needs to be a national, regional, and local strategy for how we engage. We're not the trusted messengers in every situation. So how do we support and accelerate the efforts of the organizations and individuals who are trusted messengers?
Thank you. And Charles, can you answer the same question, please?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks for having me. I guess I'm the empty chair there. My apologies for not being able to be there with you in person. So I'm the CEO and president of MedShare. For those who don't know, MedShare, we are a nonprofit organization. Our mission is to improve the quality of life of both people and our planet. And I think that the sheer foundation of our organization was built around addressing health equities or health inequities, both here at home and abroad. And I say that because it was founded on the principle that you had sheer excess of medical supplies, equipment, and medicines within the health systems here in the U.S. At the same time, you had people literally dying around the world, including at home, because they lacked key access to these quality items. So I would say the one or two items that our organization is forced to address, number one is improving overall access to quality healthcare. And we do that by providing high quality state-of-the-art, both equipment and supplies to communities who otherwise would not have it, just based on could not afford it, and in many instances, not even aware that it exists. And I'm talking here in the United States even, as well as abroad in some of the communities that we support. And so we do that by through a series of programs. We have centered around maternal child health, infectious disease control and prevention. We have primary care and respond to a number of disasters. Within that, we're also just trying to help build the health system capacity for a lot of these communities. that we're working with. So a lot of our work entails supporting here in the U.S. safety net clinics. You know, safety net clinics played such a pivotal role during the pandemic. They were addressing a lot of these inequities because these are the patients that they were seeing, the ones that could not afford to be in hospitals. And so they took care of them. And so we provided a lot of PPE to support them, protect both the health workers and also their patients. Another area that we've worked on is, one of our maternal child health programs is called the Safe Birth Initiative. And it's literally geared toward improving health outcomes in some of our marginalized communities. And what we found is that they lack many times the proper equipment to do the diagnostic work that they need to improve outcomes later on. So we've really dedicated ourselves to just addressing inequities all the way around. Most of our work is not so much pharmaceutical nature, but we do have a number of partners that bring that. But we look for a holistic approach, partner both with private sector, community-based interventions to make sure that we can be there and help them solve the issues that they're faced with, because quite frankly, they've just been left out. And a lot of our work is with the Black and brown communities, it's with the rural areas, it's with remote areas in which you have these pockets of scarcity, as I call them, as it relates to a lot of the things that we're talking about here today.
Thank you, Charles. Yeah, Charles is talking about the uninsured population. My nonprofit, we work with uninsured directly. According to CBO, there's about 30 million uninsured Americans right now. And that number is always increasing every day. Just like we have a national debt ticker that just keeps going up, the number of uninsured people keep going up on a daily basis. And with the rising cost of healthcare is not necessarily accessible, but it's not affordable. So the question to the panelists is, how are your companies really working to make sure that healthcare services are not only affordable, but accessible? Getting to the doctor's appointment is one thing, but affording all the care that's needed afterwards is another. So Martha, would you like to start?
Sure, thank you. So I think this is always a complicated question for anyone that you ask. I think in the healthcare field, how do we address the rising costs? From an AstraZeneca perspective, again, as we think about accessibility and affordability, and in talking with our advisors, we are in a place right now where we as a company are looking at our access and affordability programs to determine, are we achieving the goal that we set out to achieve with the establishment of these programs? So with our copay assistance programs and some of our medicines donations programs, are we getting to everybody we think we need to be getting to? If there are 100 eligible patients in this country for therapy X, and we're only getting to 40 of them, can we answer the question of where we're losing those other 60 individuals? And what can we do about our access and affordability programs or our market access strategy to try to close that gap and account for some of those individuals who aren't accessing the care for a multitude of reasons? So I think, again, as we look for what is our role in advancing health equity, I think we certainly feel a sense of accountability for understanding and auditing the ways that we are trying to make our medicines accessible and affordable. And we are committed to doing our part to closing those gaps, even if that requires a rethinking or a recalibration in terms of our access strategies.
So I think that, I think I agree totally. I think all companies constantly look at that, because really you could have a really great drug, but if people can't get it, it doesn't matter. And so and also, you know, being a nurse in background, you need all the tools in your toolkit that you can possibly get, because there's no silver bullet for anyone. So whatever is out there and approved and that you can use and offer up to the community, that's great. But once again, access is key. So we really saw that patient voice is really important, and that a lot of patients don't realize the power in their own stories. And so we developed a program of patient voice, and we have the tools, and they're on our website, and they can be accessible and changed around to any drug, it doesn't matter, so that patients can share their stories with their insurers. Because sometimes it's the people who are looking at these approvals don't really understand the impact that this particular patient has been experiencing, you know, and and it's not their fault. There's certain algorithms that they're supposed to follow, and we understand that. I've been dealing with insurance companies as long as I've been a nurse, which is a long time. And everyone's trying to make sure, do the best for the patient. And so I think that we really are trying to encourage our patients to share their voice and share their story and let them know that they're empowered to do that. They don't have to have someone else do that on their account. So those materials are ready. We are always working in coalitions on Medicare, on all of the issues that are out there to reduce patient costs. And we continue to do that because there's not one company that's going to be able to have a greater voice. But as a coalition together, we can share that impact with our regulators and with our lawmakers. And once again, at the end of the day, I really do believe that everyone has the patient. They really do want to do the right thing for the patient. We just are all going about it in a little bit of a different way. So if we can come together, have a shared voice, if we can work to bring those groups together, if we can make sure that we always keep the patient at the center and also empower them to participate, and caregivers too. I don't underestimate the role of a caregiver, especially when it comes to chronic diseases or diseases that become debilitating to patients. You know, your caregiver is your voice. And so we want to make sure that we honor them and equip them with all the information too. And then, you know, just really that cross collaboration, working with the White House, working with the FDA, working with all of our regulators and our lawmakers. It's just so important we keep those channels open.
I'm going to go to Charles first, and then I'm going to ask a specific question. Charles, could you?
No, thank you. Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, SafetyNet clinics, and again, just speaking about them, these are clinics that are set up providing high-quality care for uninsured or, in some cases, underinsured people here in the United States. And so one of the things we continue to do is make sure we support them. There's such a growing population of uninsured citizen is mind-boggling to me at this day and age that they're there, but they need care. And these safety net clinics continue to provide not just care, but really high-quality care. They're embedded into these communities where a lot of the people are living, so there's a high trust factor with many of them. So much of our work is really supporting them to make sure they can continue to provide those services. But secondly, what we recognize is next to salaries within a health system, I would think the medications, supplies and equipment is probably the second largest expenditure. And so where we can and come in and make that budget offsetting for these communities, they can then keep the price much cheaper at no cost to the patients and continue to provide that care. But it really is going to take a collective effort. Recognize that healthcare continue to go up, but so does the number of people that are uninsured. So you've got to have the expansion of some of these national programs to provide coverage for a lot of the citizens that, quite frankly, don't have it. And as I stated, much of the people that we're supporting, you know, unfortunately, healthcare is viewed as a luxury for them, and it's not something that's high on the priority. It's only there when they get sick. And so really just trying to work and change that mindset to promote more preventive care in these communities where that seems like a foreign concept for them. And again, just continue to support these great individuals who are just pouring their souls into caring for others on a day-to-day basis is where we feel like we've played a pivotal role in doing that.
Perfect. Thank you. So Deanne, you talked a little bit before about partnerships, working with Uber, Lyft, the YMCA. You know, COVID-19 forced us to bring a lot of people together. The White House did a tremendous job of bringing different stakeholders. So what are the lessons learned that we could take going forward in terms of fostering collaborations to help address the other social needs and healthcare needs that we have?
Yep, I would say the biggest lesson learned is that, you know, for overlooked communities, vulnerable communities, communities that have lacked resources historically. I think you said it best. We kind of still have a lot to learn. And the best way to learn about those communities and how they access resources and how they receive resources is through them. So going directly to those communities, giving them a seat at the table, instead of trying to structure policies and initiatives and plans around what we've always done, it's so much better to meet them where they are. And I think that's what you saw with the child care initiatives and the keeping the pharmacies open, you know, it just really accepting the reality that people are not going to be able to come and have, and they're not going to get vaccinated if the pharmacy isn't open when they're free. And they're definitely not going to get vaccinated if it means hiring a babysitter, you know. And instead of just saying, well, these people are going to be left behind or they'll fall through the cracks, figuring out how to provide the resources that people need and meeting them where they are is the biggest lesson learned. And I think on top of that, I think we're getting better at it. It is the convening. It is bringing both sides to the table. So bringing industry to the table, bringing advocacy groups to the table, and then bringing the real people, the people that they serve, to the table to hear directly from them. So all of these corners, with the government, the private sector, nonprofits, and people on the ground can hear, you know, what's available and what is needed, and then we can all fill in the gaps. I think we have seen a lot of that work happen. I mentioned this again with the maternal health space, and we had a call to action, and it was to do that. It was the convening of all of these spaces, and since then we just have had so much activity of people saying, we need more data. We collect this data, so how can we encourage other people to collect it? Or companies saying, we've committed this amount of money and our CEO is going to call this person and that person to get them to, donate more. So I think the energy of putting people in the room creates the action. And once people have a space where they're encouraged to share, share their stories and share their needs, I think a lot of solutions are generated.
Thank you.
Could I jump in there? Yep. Sorry. I think I love everything that you said. I think my hope, and I think everyone's hope in this room, is that spirit, the humility, that immediate holding of hands to say, what can we do together, that happened when we were all in the middle of COVID, doesn't go away. I think the temptation to think, okay, we're out of crisis mode, so let's kind of shake it off and go back to business as usual, is going to be strong for a lot of people, for a lot of companies, for a lot of organizations. We have to fight back against that and say everything we learned about collaborating, convening, breaking down those walls, we have to find a way to make that sustainable. Otherwise, we are not going to solve this problem. We go up, we go down, we go up, we go down. We don't have that luxury anymore. And so I think if we can grab hold of those things that have worked so well over the last 2 years and commit to not letting go of those until, you know, never, ever, but let's make progress, let's hang on tight to those learnings, that to me is what I'm hopeful that we will all take away from this.
No, excellent point. I concur with your sentiments. Just a show of hands, how many people work in a community-based organization in the audience? So raise your hand if you work at a community-based organization. How many grant writers are in the room? People that write grants to help fund projects and stuff. So now we're gonna try to get cheat codes, because my nonprofit, we're predominantly grant-funded, so we have funders in the room, we have some people that are in charge of foundations, so we need to get to some real talk about how do we get money.
Yeah.
You know, over the past 2 days, we've talked about distinctive themes around the need to build trust and to build true partnerships within the community. The problem is, as community-based organizations, the boots on the ground that are doing the work on a day-to-day basis, we can't do that work if we don't have the talented workforce that's on our teams to continue that work. And a lot of this restrictions when it comes to funding opportunities, to fund projects, there's a restriction on using that money towards general operating expenses, and also covering staff salaries. We have a lot of conversation the past 2 days talking about the workforce, diversify the workforce. It's great diversifying the workforce, but you don't want an unemployed workforce. So as community-based organizations, we need funding in order to keep hiring, you know, talented individuals to meet the needs of our community. So the question for you guys is, how can we create more proactive collaborations between pharmaceutical companies, healthcare companies, and community-based organizations that are directly engaged in serving the vulnerable populations? Because life is not like a Grey's Anatomy episode. Mm-hmm. We can't solve all of our problems in 1 hour. Like, we figured out what this illness is, and here's the treatment, and let's make this, you know, story end. There's no cliffhanger. Now, our communities are suffering on a daily basis, and we talk about the patient journey a lot, where we always talk about one illness, You know, a lot of the conversation talked about lupus or kidney disease or diabetes as individual topics, but there are so many of our community members that suffer from all combined illnesses. They have diabetes that leads to kidney failure. They also might be suffering from lupus as well. So we need to think about the person as a whole, and community-based organizations and groups that are trying to actively work need the support in order to make that happen. So give us the cheat codes. What can we do in order to really make sure that the partnerships are actually formed that allow us to go and do this incredible work?
Sure, I can start with that. So I think it's important. Well, one thing is all about relationship, right? And so you come to these meetings and you meet all of us on the stage or in the audience or sitting down having a drink. And so I would say take advantage of those relationships. You know, ask a question, send an email. Don't be afraid of no, because you might get a yes, right? Or you might get, and I say this all the time, there's no way that we are gonna be able to solve all the problems, give all the money that is needed out there. I have no problem with introducing anyone to somebody from a different company, to connecting advocacy groups to other advocates from different pharma companies, to connecting the pharma companies to different advocacy groups. I've done it my whole career, because we're not gonna be the only answer. And so it's not a competition. It's about supporting the work that you all are doing and that many of your colleagues and our colleagues are doing on the ground. It's about making sure that we have mission match. So this is really important. We are probably one of the most regulated industries, if not probably the most regulated industry. And so we are bound by guidelines that I can't even begin to share with you all, because there's just so many. And I mean, what we can support, we can't, where the firewalls are. So it's just a matter of a conversation and understanding that we have to have a mission match. Give you an example. We do not work in the area of diabetes, and so if a diabetes organization came and said we would like you to support something, we can't. And it's not because we don't believe in your mission or don't want those patients to be helped. It's because we don't want to appear like we may be marketing or supporting something that we're not in that area. I mean, this is how the nuance is so important. So understand when you're approaching a company, understand what their mission is. Ask. You know, we are in a variety of therapeutic areas, but diabetes is not one of them. And so I'd say that, you know, I think really it's a matter of just being a little bit bold, and hopefully these kinds of conferences will give you the kind of encouragement to do that. One of the things I said that we do that I'm really proud of, so about 3 years ago, we started the Mallinckrodt Advocacy Advisory Board, and we are in about 13 therapeutic areas, and so there's one organization from each therapeutic area that comes together as part of this board, and we meet quarterly. And so usually what happens is when you're in the lupus space or you're in the nephrology space, you speak to other nephrology groups, or you speak to other lupus groups. This is such a different, every kind of healthcare you can think, we have arthritis, we have sarcoidosis, we have nephrotic syndrome, we have cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, we have NICU, we're just really, every therapeutic area that we focus on has a representative in this group. And the beauty of that is you are sharing best practices, and this is where it's so important, because everybody's working with different populations. We work in the area of sarcoidosis, which has a disproportionate burden on the Black community. And so that the experiences of that group, and as well as myositis, really kind of helps other groups understand how they can work with their communities. So I think it's that cross collaboration, it's the discussion, it's being bold. You know, those are just a few of the ideas I have.
I think it's also, you know, it's our responsibility to also listen. A lot of what we heard over the last 18 months is that there's a particular position of power and privilege that we sit in as a pharmaceutical manufacturer in this country. And with that comes a significant responsibility. And if we are hearing from the community that there's not enough investment at regional and local level, we need to ask ourselves, what do we have available? What tools, resources do we have available at our disposal to change the model of how we invest? Which is why we're looking at, again, it has to be national, it has to be regional, it has to be local. How can we open up the channels that we have to make sure that all of your organizations do have an opportunity to approach AstraZeneca and find a way to collaborate? And so we are in the middle of an open application period called the Community Solutions Challenge. It's our second year of doing this national open application. It is only open to regional and local groups. It is not for national organizations, which our team, I think, is very skilled at and used to working with. but this is an opportunity for us to start to form partnerships and get closer to the individuals and organizations who are doing impactful and meaningful work in the communities that we are trying to reach. And so last year, $750,000, this year, $1 million will go out the door open to any organization for up to $25,000, and not a complicated grant application process. You are not jumping through 8 million hoops like an organization that has 2,000 full-time people on staff with official grant writers. We have tailored the process to engage with us to match the capacity, capability, et cetera, of the organizations we're trying to reach. That's one small step, but I think it's just an example, again, of we need to be listening and responding with the tools and resources we have. And that's why we're looking at what we do as a business. That's why we're looking at what we do on the foundation side, because we really believe that the time for meaningful change is now. And so as much as we are looking outward for answers, we are also looking inward and holding ourselves to account based, again, on the position that we are in to be able to make some of these opportunities more of a reality. We want you to be able to work with us, whether you're an NMQF or a local organization in Town X. So,
Charles.
Yeah, I just want to say that's great. And I want to say on behalf of the nonprofit world, a big thank you to the pharma companies, the other corporations. You guys do tremendous work, and we're very, very appreciative of all that you do. I'm a true believer in powerful partnerships and these public-private partnerships bringing about lasting change in this community. So I would just encourage us to continue to look for ways that we can partner at a community-based level. And don't underestimate what was said earlier about investing in our talent and in general operating. I think, as you mentioned, this is one of the most highly regulated industries around, and yet when you look at the nonprofit sector, and I worked many years with Johnson & Johnson, so I can speak about this intelligently, that the resource and the capabilities aren't always there. And so we are often limited by the types of qualitative personnel that we can bring on board to do the great things we really need to have them do. So, you know, we're in competition with the workforce in general, so it's no longer that, you know, I'm going to go to a nonprofit to do good and I'm going to go somewhere else to do well. We really have to merge those where you can do well and do good at the same time, really invest in the capabilities of our nonprofits, making sure, you know, the processes are up to par, making sure the talent is there, making sure that we're operating in the way that you would like, you know, these organizations to operate. And I think we can do a lot more together. So even though it may not be exact alignment with the outcome-based program, I think if you look internally, there's probably some opportunities to engage us. Maybe it's on a technology upgrade, maybe it's a talent plan, or also lending your talent, which you've done quite often amount of time, whether it be through an executive loan or bringing in and you know, because we lacked a lot of times some of the current opportunities or learnings that may be out in the workforce, and bringing those in to nonprofits, I think can only strengthen us moving forward. But I just want to say on behalf of all nonprofits, though, I think you guys do a phenomenal work. And what we're talking about is how to make it better, because what you're doing has just been fantastic. So thank you.
Thank you, Charles. Deanne, how can we as community-based organizations work closer with the White House to let the voice of the people that we're serving become more visible?
Yes, I'm glad you asked, and I just really appreciated this conversation because it brought kind of two stories to mind. I had the good fortune of working for the vice president when she was a senator, and one of the bills she introduced was a uterine fibroid research bill. And we were able to do that and to do that work because we worked directly with the Fibroid Foundation, a nonprofit. And at the time in the Senate, you know, so much attention was focused on the Affordable Care Act, and the usual suspects were at the table for that. And it really, the lesson of working with the Fibroid Foundation and introducing the bill and the way the legislation would receive, the way funding and the conversation around fibroids and diseases like that, that disproportionately impact Black women, that lead to disproportionate consequences in maternal health, just the whole the whole consequence, the whole result of that, you know, all started from us being able to work with this nonprofit that's not normally brought to the table. And so funding those nonprofits obviously is important for them to have the resources and the workers and all of that. It really makes a big difference in the conversation. And then the other anecdote that it reminds me of, when we were working on COVID, we consistently got feedback that, you know, we obviously, as you all know, we faced the challenge of vaccine hesitancy. We consistently got feedback that the best way to break through to that was kind of like neighbor to neighbor, community to community. And so it wasn't even like, it was like the Fibroid Foundation was too large of a nonprofit. It needed to be even more local, even more kind of block to block. And it just really underscores how necessary it is to do the work that you all have mentioned. And so bringing it back to your question, working with the White House, I think to your point, like, we have taken that lesson, we have learned that lesson. Our goal throughout is to bring these groups to the table. And it's on us to do the convenings. But I would say for any nonprofits out there, please reach out. We have an open door. We will reach out to you, but know that that is our goal, is to bring your voices to the table, not only the nonprofits, but also the people you serve. We want to hear your stories. We want to know better ways to serve you. And I think just the constant collaboration, constant communication is the way that we're going to be able to find the right solutions to the issues that we face.
Thank you. So Catherine had brought up a great point earlier about networking. You know, it's important to ask a question and to really just talk to your neighbor. And if someone says no, you keep going and persisting forward. So I want to share a story. About two or three years ago when I came to the NMQF Summit, you know, one of the big passions for my organization is diabetes. We provide life-saving medication to the uninsured. And insulin was one of those things that was very, very hard to get, whether it's insulin vials or pens. But through the power of networking and being persistent, I was able to connect with the pharmaceutical company and have a conversation explaining the need for the community that I serve. They were able to come and actually do a site visit at my nonprofit based here in Virginia to see how we're serving the community. I was just hoping for a pilot. Like, just please, let's do a pilot so that way we can make a business case to do this nationally. After they saw going to the clinic, seeing the patients getting assisted, seeing the conversations with the medical providers, they decided, you know what? We're not gonna do a pilot. We're just gonna make this nationwide. So the power of talking to your neighbor is extremely important. So what Catherine said is, you do have to be persistent. You may have an idea, but you have to be passionate and willing to work towards it. So it is very important that we kind of keep thinking big dreams and really thinking about methodically, how can we do this that's sustainable? Not just a one-time effort, but more of an ongoing effort. And right now, through our advocacy efforts, working with the pharmaceutical industry, we have made insulin available for uninsured people all across the country for free. There are many different organizations, Dispensary of Hope, Direct Relief, and AmeriCares, that are working directly with pharmaceutical company partnerships to provide insulin to safety net clinics so that we can give it out to uninsured individuals all across America. So I want to give time for having Q&A. So if you have any questions, please come to the microphone so we can provide more insight and get some more cheat codes. You know, I was taking notes. I'm like, I got to tell my grant team, this is what we got to write. So if you have any questions, please come up to the mic. They have the money. You got to ask the questions now. So I'm not seeing anyone yet, but one of the questions that I have for you is, or actually one of the concerns I have as executive director of a nonprofit, is the burnout within our employees. You know, the cost of living has dramatically increased. So we can't retain, you know, nonprofits, you don't go to the nonprofit world to make millions of dollars. The people that are working in nonprofits all across the country are passionate about the work that they do. But the problem is that we don't always have the ability to pay them what they're really worth. And that is one of the challenges of looking at how can we address the potential for this tsunami of workforce shortage within the nonprofit community, because if people can't afford to live in the communities that they're serving, they're going to look at other sectors. So it looks like we have a question, right?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mani Keita Fakaya, I'm the research manager for the Deloitte Center for Health Solutions and the Health Equity Institute. I was trying to think about how to formulate my question. That's why I didn't come up earlier. My background is in research, and that's the lens that I bring, trying to support the collaboration between evidence-based practice and then what we've learned recently about practice-based evidence as well. So in thinking about research, and the purpose of research is to generate knowledge and information, and that's really what should guide our actions, and community members are doing this work every day, so we should use our research background to elevate that work and inform other activities. But I find that research is still very much it's a siloed thing, and it's not used on a large scale. What are your thoughts on how knowledge generation can be used to inform future health equity activities and to really bring them up to scale the way that they should be?
Wow, that's quite a question. I think, you know, so pharmaceutical research is, you know, we do two kinds. One is we do internal research, which is usually on our products or on the disease states that we do. And then we also fund investigator-initiated trials. So that, what you're talking about probably falls more in that line of looking at diversity and looking at, and but mostly in the areas that's related to where your products are in the therapeutic areas. Because it's all closely all aligned within a company. So and I think that kind of research is critical. I think it's critical. You know, what we are, but I'm also, I say that, but I had an eye-opening experience when I was in New Orleans at this conference, at the Forums Conference in New Orleans, because Gary Puckerin said something about the fact that evidence-based medicine was based on racism, and I was like, what? I've been a nurse for a long time, I never heard that. And so I got clarity that all the trials that are related to all that evidence base are often predominantly white participants.
Homogenous
data. And I hadn't even, and I'm a nurse for a long time, I hadn't even thought about that. And so I think that that's what we have to be better at. So we have to be better at representing the communities in which we're at, in the world, right? In our world, the US, in our community, in Florida, where I live, or wherever it is that you are. I think we have to be really, really intentional about that to get that kind of information. But I think data is the key. Data is what drives, what changes formularies. Data is what changes algorithms for payment. Data is the key. So that would be my answer. The more we can do that, the more data we can get on these studies, the better it's going to be. And I think every company has different focuses. So it'd be hard to know. It's not like the pharmaceutical company comes together and all funds this kinds of research or that kind of research. Every company is different on what their focus is.
But I think your question is one that is what makes working in the health act, what can make it so difficult is that there's no playbook for any of this work that we are doing. And so we're finding ourselves in that building mode of, okay, if we want to move toward transformational change as a company, as a culture, as an organization, how do we do that? Knowing that the historic ways we've gathered data are not telling the story. So I think what you're asking is such a key question, but I think one that there currently isn't an easy answer to, other than to say, I think there's acknowledgement we need to go there, but we've got to work together in terms of what that data looks like. And I think part of why that's scary is because it's outside of everybody's comfort zone. We're used to this very kind of typical way of looking at how you collect information and make a decision, and this is a little bit different from that. It's almost like I was on a panel a couple of weeks ago at the American College of Cardiology, and there was a cardiologist on the panel that talked about how in his first grand rounds he had asked a question around, you know, how do we address with our patients social determinants of health? And at the time the surgeon looked at him and said, like, are you a surgeon or are you a sociologist? And I think we're now officially in that era where this is we're seeing the confluence of what all of that information together can do for us to tell the story and be the impetus for change moving forward. So I think really critical question that there just simply isn't an answer to right now.
Well, hopefully we can all work together.
Let's do it.
To develop an
Let's
answer.
Let's do it.
That's really what I'm sensing and hoping for.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Over here.
Thank you. My name is Clarence Fluker, and I'm with the Association of American Medical Colleges. And my question centers around the word you just used, confluence. And so I'm just curious to know from the corporate folks, we know that you all have foundation money and sometimes marketing money and things like that to invest in communities, but that really meets an immediate social need in most cases. So I'm interested in knowing, how do you work with, or are you thinking about partnering with your government relations colleagues in corporate to also go about addressing some of the more upstream policy issues that have trickled down to the things that you now need to like fix with, you know, with money, because policy can sometimes meet something further upstream so that you don't have to deal with it downstream.
A great question, and I think for most pharmaceutical companies right now, they're organized in a way where the individuals in roles working with nonprofit organizations are on the same sort of collective teams with government affairs and policy professionals, because there is this acknowledgement of everything we do has short, medium, and long-term implications, and how are we making sure we're, again, kind of working across all three of those perspectives or timelines. And so partnering with government affairs and policy, I think, is critical to all of us and all of our roles. And we're definitely seated in the right place with the organization, within our organizations. I think your other question, though, about historically, as the dollars have come from marketing, there's that constant tension between a marketing team and a company is used to looking at quarter-to-quarter results. Health equity is a long game, right? This is not going to be that something is going to change in the next 30, 60, 90 days. And so I think it's also incumbent on individuals in roles like ours in pharmaceutical companies to do a combination of the storytelling that is so important, and we have heard from everybody today, and some of those hardcore policy and kind of long-term change data points that we need to help convince the business that this is the new way of working. And so the same way we are working with all of you externally, we also spend a lot of our time internally trying to help individuals who don't do this work every day understand why it's important and understand why we need to work differently today than we, more differently than we ever have, if we're going to support and accelerate change in the external environment.
Thank you to all of you for your comments and for this panel. I'm Patty Doikis. I'm Executive Director for Global Health and Health Equity at Bristol-Myers Squibb. And I really loved hearing about carrying principles of equity in terms of shifting power and money, and getting resources into the hands of organizations that haven't had them before. So one thing I wanted to share is that a metric for us is, who have we funded that we have never, funded before? Just to see that we're pushing the perimeter on the organizations that we work with. And then the question I have for the panel is, you know, we're always being asked about metrics. And when we're talking about transformative change and not just process metrics of, did activities happen? Was the money spent and activities taking place? So I just wonder, what are big needles from your perspective to move on health equity that we could share with the group and that we can all get behind? I'm so encouraged when we had, for the first time through COVID-19, in the White House, somebody focused on health equity, which I was hoping would drive a national agenda and set of goals around health equity that we could all get behind and push hard on. So we'd just love to hear, what are big metrics for you all?
Do you want to start?
Spoken a lot, so I feel like...
So metrics, you know, we work hard at not being transactional, just supporting a program and then walking away. So I attend most of the programs where we try to work together to talk, you know, to understand what's trying to be accomplished. But at the and then we ask for follow-up on all of our programs so that we know that, you know, that they accomplished what they were hoping to accomplish. But I think really it's coming to a time where we're going, you know, because I think it's coming to a time where we need to ask more of that. And I give this an example. You know, I've been doing healthcare for a while, as many of you have, as some of you have. Some of you are fresh-faced and new, but some of you have been around. And we're having the same discussions we've had. I'm having the same discussion I had in the first year of nursing in terms of health equity. And a little bit changed, but really just so sad that we haven't come so much further. And so I'd say that we have to all be challenged. So we come to this conference, and I say this to you, and I say this to me, what are we going to take from this conference? We've heard from some amazing speakers, but what is the ask? You know, how are we going to use this conference, these conversations, as a change agent? Can we? When we meet together again next year, will this just be another discussion, or will we be able to share some best practices? Did somebody go home and call their legislator to talk about one of the bills that was discussed? Did someone go home and talk about one of the programs and actually initiate something internally? I love this idea of your community, of looking at small groups and regional groups. It's something I'm thinking about. Can I come next year and share that we did something like that? You know, really, I think we've got to challenge ourselves that for the programs that we support, for the programs that we attend, you know, this is time. Our time is so valuable, but what are we going to do with it? How can we really change the scope of healthcare by making a difference? And I read something once, what if 100% of the people that came here, every one of us, left here raring and committed to making one change? When we come back together next year, how exciting would that be for us to share those changes and what happened? And I think that that's what we have to really ask ourselves. So metrics are hard when you're rating somebody else's program, because it's really about what they're trying to accomplish, and we're just supporting what their work that they're doing. But I'd say at the end of the day, do you accomplish what you did? Has something changed? Are you improving healthcare in any way? Did somebody get information that they couldn't have gotten beforehand?
I'm Patty. Thank you for the question, and it's good to see you. When I talked earlier about, like, how do you take some of the storytelling and then marry it up with some of these hard data points, I think that's where we are right now, because I don't know that I ever see us being purely in the nothing but hardcore numbers, because I think you lose some of the person impact that sits behind them. It's almost like the data doesn't show you who's sitting behind those numbers. It's important for decision making, we know that in pharma, but it doesn't actually get at some of the reason why this is so important. And so we're looking at kind of moving forward, asking ourselves, what do they look like? So we're in the process of building what we think some metrics might be, and we're very interested in looking at them in two different ways. So the sort of bigger metric of, if we are responsible and doing the right things and making the right investments as an industry collectively, is that going to impact or move the needle in terms of trust? Because we know that trust is a big element of the decision making in whether or not to get vaccinated or whether or not to go on a new therapy and stay on that therapy. So we want to understand, is there an impact on kind of overall trust in medicine? And then we also want to look at some of the actual hard metrics, like if you have a population in a clinical trial that actually mirrors what the real world population in that disease state looks like, how does that impact the timeline to recruit the study, read out the study, get approval for the study? And then how does that impact your market access strategy to make sure that after you've done all that work to recruit right, that at the end of the day, those folks and the people in their communities can then access the medicine once it's approved? So also some of those more kind of hardcore at the almost like the business level, what is this work actually doing to make sure that we're closing gaps in terms of who's accessing care in a meaningful and sort of timely way? So we're looking at it in those dimensions and trying not to lose the storytelling element, which is, I think, sometimes where our marketing colleagues and others sort of think of our work as like the soft function. But in reality, that's a very compelling element of the overall kind of picture that we want to paint. So we're looking across all of those dimensions. We don't have the answers, but we're thinking if we can push ourselves to go into those spaces that we might land closer to where we need to be in terms of measuring, are we actually impacting health equity in the country? So I hope that's helpful. We're a work in progress. We're very humble about that, but we are really trying to approach this differently and in a sustainable way.
We'd love to learn with you and work together, so thank you.
Thanks, Patty.
So we're almost up at time. The panels will be here after the discussion to answer any questions that we were not able to get to. So I'm going to take one final quick question before we wrap up.
Thank you all. My name is Camille Pope. I'm the Chief Medical Lead at Acclinate. We've talked a lot today and yesterday about how healthcare is local, and thank you, Martha, for talking about AZ's five-year road plan at the local, regional, and national levels. But we all know that pharmaceutical companies are global organizations. And so when we think about clinical trial diversity or access, you know, it's not just impacting the U.S., it's impacting outside of the U.S. as well. But in this room, we're primarily U.S.-based. So wanting to ask you, how are you balancing those priorities when it comes to diversity, access, equitable care? Because it looks different in every country, but you know, here in the U.S. it looks a certain way, and we know that as a company you have to balance those dollars, balance that focus. So I think folks might appreciate some insight on how companies are thinking about that.
Thank you.
So I think in two ways, Camille, and thank you for the question, and Camille, before she's at this new role, spent time with us at AstraZeneca, and we're devastated that she left, and Camille was an instrumental contributor to the five-year roadmap, so thank you, Camille. We're looking at it in two ways. I think the first one is we're saying it might be different in the U.S., and we may be further along in terms of addressing or talking about more openly some of the societal issues like systemic racism that are driving this. Let us be your petri dish. Let us be your best practice. Let us come out and do some really good work in this space. Let us make it easy for you, global pharmaceutical company, to say that we can be successful in moving the needle on health equity. So I think first and foremost, we are trying to say, take our blueprint, use our blueprint, tell our story, stand it up, replicate it, change it, scale it, do whatever you want with it, but let us help you show that this work can be done in a meaningful way, I think, number one. And number two, I think it's not letting people get away with saying, well, the time is right in the U.S., it's not really right anywhere else. Like, your issues are different. They might be different, but equity, health equity, is 100% an issue in every country across the globe. And so I think not letting them use that difference in the conversation or how you define health equity be an excuse to not make it a global ambition. So two ways, let us help you help yourself, and let us not give you a way to say not can't be done right now outside of the U.S.
And I'll just add that sometimes we have this thing that what we do in America is good for the world, and that's not necessarily true. Everybody's at a different place, so you really have to understand the country, the area that you're working in, what the needs are, and respect that. And I think that's really cool, crucial, I think, for you to be able to be successful wherever you are in getting trials, you know, for getting people into trials that you want in there, and using and getting programs that actually get to the person. Because once again, each place, if you know one country, you know one country.
I want to thank the panelists for joining us today for the final session at today's summit. So let's give them a round of applause.